This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Matt Preston, welcome to Better Reading.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for having me in.
Hey, listen, there's a couple of things we have in common. I don't know if you know this, but yes. I'm going to tell you. I love food and I love cooking.
Yes.
Lebanese Australian, so I grew up.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I've been cooking since I was 9.
Favourite dish your mother made you?
Tabbouleh.
Why? That's really interesting. Why tabbouleh? I would have thought it would be something, often normally it's something protein-based, but that's really interesting you choose a salad.
I just love it so much. But the other thing
is, crisp and driven by the parsley and the lemon juice.
Favourite salad. And mashi wada anib, the vine leaves, the stuffed vine leaves.
Yeah, okay.
Mashi is really...
Yeah.
I was
Molokhia, you're not a Molokhia fan, slimy Molokhia?
No. Shabashli, sweet, the cheese and semolina.
What about surely chicken and almond rice?
Oh yeah, I make that all the time.
Isn't that nice?
Made that for Ottolini. Kibbeh. Yeah.
Kibinaya
is my favourite.
Is that your favourite as well?
Yeah.
So what you're doing is you've taken the Lebanese cookbook and you've just gone, find me the fresh, the fresh bright stuff.
But I'm doing that, which is great.
You need everything else. But the two things you pick are very Australian in terms of lots of acid, lots of freshness, lots of crispness.
There's two things. I'm just going to tell you these stories and that's what, before we start with what have we got in common. The reason why I love tabbouleh so much is because it was always fresh and she made it for us and 6 kids, 2 adults, 8 people. Can you imagine cooking that every night? But anyway, she was so proactive, very religious, Christian, always at the church at St. Bridget's at Marrickville. One day I was walking through with a friend of mine, as teenagers, right?
Yeah.
And there was a Lebanese food stall and I stopped and I bought some food from the fete. And I said to whoever I was with at the time, I said, oh my God, this tastes like my mother's cooking. It is so fantastic. Anyway, we walked home because we lived in Marrickville. We walked home and I said to my mother, you're never going to believe it. There's this fantastic stall and who supplied the food?
No.
It was her.
No. How brilliant. But that shows your palate was on point if you can identify it.
I'm good like that. But the vine leaf story, I will tell you, we were very poor. We immigrated. Mm. I was born here, but, you know, there were 6 of us and I think that's where my love of food comes from. We came to a butcher in Redfern, right? And we lived upstairs. His name was Antoine Andlefort, made the best Lebanese sausages ever. But he used to, minimal rent, I think it was. One room, one kitchenette, one bathroom.
Right.
And you would live in it as a family until you found your feet, right?
Yeah, sure.
But we found our feet in Glebe in a corner shop, right? That's where my parents ended up. And my mother used to ask neighbours for their vine leaves because they'd have vines and they wouldn't know what to do with them, right? Like all those vine leaves. So we'd have to go up there, knock on the door, right?
Can
I take it? And then the next day we would take them a bowl of vine leaves. She would give back by giving them the actual masha.
Which they would have loved.
I mean, I just love that. Yeah. I love that so much.
But I think that's a fascinating thing when people come here from another place. And I remember going down to Lekemba and getting involved in a very surprisingly collegiate conversation between a radical Muslim cleric and a very conservative Lebanese business gentleman. Mm. And it was about, and they were discussing the perfect way to make kibbeh. And it was a beautiful conversation. two people who would probably, in any other, have nothing else in common.
Probably.
But when it came to the food that their mothers had cooked for them or their fathers had cooked for them, they were really passionate and they were energizing with each other. And it's it's such a terrible cliche, but it brings people together. Yeah, food definitely brings people together.
Okay, so the other thing we have in common is we're both big mouths.
Yes, I know that.
Yeah. So I get myself into a lot of trouble all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping this podcast won't get me into trouble.
Is that because you don't have a filter?
No, I'm good. I can pick the mood in a room.
Right.
I don't have Tourette's or anything like that. And I feel as though I've got a filter, but I have no fear. And I wear my heart on my sleeve. But I do like to sound things out, to say things that people are too afraid to say sometimes.
Sure. And that's a very tricky thing to do now because of context.
Yeah.
More than anything else, because everything becomes out of context and people are not taking, and also half the time people aren't listening.
Yeah.
And they hear a bit of it and they go, she must be saying that or he must be saying this, and then they fire off on that basis.
Yeah,
so
it's
really, it's a real challenge that this kind of, this engage in debate and have debate, great, to just, I mean, I've done radio where I've had someone on talking about the performance of politicians through the years, and as this person has said stuff, he's being berated by the left and the right for being an apologist for one side or the other. And you go, but he said the same thing, but he said one thing and both sides have read it as the exact antithesis of what the other side's read. How can that be? But that's because we're not listening. We're not really thinking. We're just firing off. We're hearing what we expect to hear, and then we're already in an angry state.
And, you know, I think I'm always warned about speaking to different people or having different people on the podcast. I try to mix it up and people say, oh, be careful. You know, you'll polarise people. Well, I couldn't care less. That I couldn't care less about.
Yeah, I think your job is to bring interesting stories. It doesn't really matter where they're from. And sometimes those stories are going to be confronting stories.
Yeah, and they're going to be hard stories.
But people are funny about that kind of confronting, you know, because people come to your podcast. Some may just want to laugh. Some may just want something to listen to with their cup of tea. They're having at 4 o'clock before they get stuck into dinner. And some are coming because they want an in-depth conversation. So again, how people come to you and the mood they're in. It's like people going to restaurants. You can't change. You can't change the mood when they walk in. You can shift it over time. When they listen, you can make them feel comfortable. But if they're coming grumpy and angry, tricky.
You know, I mean, we're in difficult times at the moment, and we'll mark that. But I'm kind of very pro humanity, and I'm really vocal about it, and I have been. And I had friends around for dinner, dear friends, the other day, because everybody congregates at my place because they like the food, and no one brought it up. Not one person. And every one of them would have seen my Instagram. Every one of them knows how I feel about it.
Yeah.
And it's not... And you know what? Big mouth shut up that night. I thought, you know what? I'm not going to go there.
But it's interesting because there are certain things that we're trained from pretty much every cultural background. We're trained not to talk about certain things. And that's why sport has such a big role in Australian society for so many people, because you can talk about that. But discussing religion,
something
you can't talk about. But in England, it'll be the weather, and you don't talk about religion, you don't talk about politics, and you probably don't. And prehistorically, you probably didn't discuss what your friends all did in the bedroom. You know, they were the three areas that were kind of almost taboo, and so you know, we develop a certain range of safe places that
we can discuss.
Food's another safe place we can discuss.
Okay, let me introduce. Matt Preston is an award-winning food journalist, radio presenter, and international TV personality. With over 11 seasons on MasterChef Australia, Matt reached an audience of more than 180 million people across 110 countries. Oh my God, you're a show-off. He has published...
I'm not a show-off. I have other people to show-off for me. And I could never read that out myself. I would have edited that bit out because it sounds so ridiculous, doesn't it?
But it's
so
true.
So ridiculous.
He has been published... He has published 8 best-selling cookbooks, including Matt Preston's World of Flavor. Now he opens up about himself for the first time with his memoir, Big Mouth. Like Matt himself, it is a joyous, funny, and larger-than-life book, and it really is. Okay, I want to start with where you grew up and how you came to be Matt Preston.
Oh, gee, well, becoming Matt Preston is, I think for most people, is that moment when they see you on TV.
Yeah.
So, and that's not Matt Preston because that's the 10% that gets amplified of anyone who goes on telly. So you find that people are very different when you meet them off screen. I tend to find that TV tends to amplify people, it tends to make them better versions of they are because mm. because they're scrutiny and so they behave well. There's a tiny group that, yeah. that makes them worse, and then you share with your friends who they are and with other people in the industry, and then you make sure you don't have to work with them. So I think in terms of the Matt Preston everyone knows is undoubtedly the Matt Preston of 11 seasons on MasterChef. Maybe that's been twisted slightly by taking on stuff that I have no natural aptitude for. Food's a comfortable space for me. I know my way around that. I've been doing it for a long time. But, you know, finding myself on Masked Singer, finding myself on Dancing with the Stars, very different.
Did you do that?
Yeah, I did both.
Was that hard?
Dancing with the Stars was really hard. Oh, yeah. Really hard because you're training for 5 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Wow.
And also because you don't understand the language, it's a different area. Yeah. It's like me trying to tell someone how to write a review. It's like, you know, there's so many different steps that you intrinsically know that you have to learn.
Were you a good dancer?
No, I'm a great 3 a.m. in the morning dancer. I'm a great last one on the last floor. But ballroom is very different, and it's very meticulous, and it's very structured, and the rules are very firm. You know, this stuff. So, but did I enjoy it? I had such a good time. I'm still dancing with my dance partner
from
the show. So we dance twice
dancing,
a week.
I mean, I'm hopeless. I've got no rhythm whatsoever. But I do love watching it, and I think it can only make you happy.
Or allow yourself to let go because you have to forget everything else. You're just concentrating. And it's like golf, and some people, you know, there's a therapeutic kind of almost meditative quality. I also think the other thing about it is, and this is one of those things as I've got older, I become more and more, just you give stuff a go.
Yeah.
And if you're no good at it, it doesn't matter because the worst thing someone can say is you're no good at it, and that's true. So it really doesn't hurt. There's no humiliation there. But, you know, if you do it and you get some joy out of it, then how fantastic is that?
I took up boxing during COVID.
Why did you take up boxing?
During COVID. Right, so I thought because you could do it in the park. And so I got a trainer and did it in the park.
How did that feel when you landed that first punch, when you actually felt your weight go through the punch and you go, that's what he's been talking about. That's what she's been talking about. That's a good moment.
Even though
you're never going to fight for a heavyweight championship.
That's where I was going. I think my stamina is better, definitely. But my technique, I reckon I'm still as hopeless as I was four years ago.
But the whole point about it is you're better and you're getting joy out of it.
And I think fun.
And I think this whole idea, I think there's this strange attitude people have about if I'm going to do something, I need to be amazing at it. And the answer is, you're not going to make the Olympics.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to be a legend. But if you get joy out of it and if you try something new, the satisfaction of climbing small hills when you're starting on the it's a hill. I'm on a hill.
Yeah.
And I think that whole idea about, and I'm trying to explain to people, the best way I found is think about golf. Think about how many terrible golf players are out there, a terrible tennis player there, who play every week because they love it so much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you don't need to be great at stuff.
I'll tell you something else. I've been swimming almost all my life.
Right.
Like, I was at a weird Lebanese background.
Yep.
My father took us to Coogee Beach, just threw us in the water, and that's how we learned to swim. So I've been lapping for almost every single day. I'm still the slowest person in the pool.
Okay, well, this is interesting because I love swimming as well.
I love it.
I'm not very good at it.
We got a lot in common.
I recently, with two Greek friends and two Italian friends and the woman I love, we went down to our local pool where there's a legend called Bucky who trains, and we had training session with her, and it was really good.
Stroke correction,
and suddenly it became it's like skiing.
Yes,
you know, when you're fighting
your way
down the slope, it's really hard, but you get the straight, you get a little bit longer, a little bit, oh my gosh, what a difference. So, but that moment for me, you know, that was like, that was $50 well spent. I went, oh my gosh. And then I was swimming in the harbour yesterday. It's like, gee, that feels so much better. So I think
maybe I need to do that.
That we talk a lot about mindfulness, and we talk about this idea of moving from being a conscious incompetent into being the four stages of knowledge. You start with being an unconscious incompetent. You don't know how bad you are. You then become a conscious incompetent. You know how bad you are.
Yeah,
then you
I'm
become,
there.
Then the next step is to become a conscious competent. You go, wow. Oh, my stamina's better now. And then finally is the unconscious competent where you're just doing it and it's easy.
I live in San Francisco for three months of the year and I swim there. I mean, the weather's appalling. I'm only ever there in winter. But anyway, I swim.
So whereabouts are you? Knob Hill? Whereabouts are you?
I'm in the Mission.
Oh, lovely.
I rent the same house every time. Very nice. And it's a 35-minute walk to the pool. And I'm the slowest over there as I am here. And one time when I was there, this was last year, this guy came and he had no legs and he jumped in the pool. And I thought, you know, I don't know if this is PC, but I did feel, oh, well, at least there'll be one person that I can beat in the pool. No. Yeah. He beat me hands down. He was in the fast lane, and he was a fantastic swimmer.
So you've never been tempted to do the Alcatraz? Because there's a famous swim you can do, open water swim, which is the Alcatraz swim, where you swim over from Alcatraz.
No. Oh, I couldn't do that. Well, oh, I'd be too
sharky.
Scared. Oh, yeah, too scared. Have you done it?
No. My friend done it, said it was amazing.
Yeah. Anyway.
But, oh, yeah, too sharky.
Go back. I want to know where you grew up.
I grew up in London. I grew up in the borders between Chelsea and Fulham in London.
So
Chelsea, obviously, so that's round the corner from where punk started, around the corner from where there were a lot of, you know, trendy boutiques. King's Road was kind of like the other great hippie territory, along with, you know, Carnaby Street, some mods, and then it moved out to that. But the area I grew up was a place called World's End, which was aptly named because it was I grew up behind a brewery where the sound was big brown bottles rattling around in wooden crates, and all the workers wearing clogs, and the sound of breaking glass, and the sound of glass being ground into the concrete of the loading yard underneath a wooden clog. So that's where I grew up. It was one of those kind of borderline areas, you know, famous because it's also where the Rolling Stones, when they started, they used to live. That's where Keith Richards lived, in a basement flat with Mick Jagger, and Keith slept in the bath because there was no bed for him. So it was kind of a netherworldy place. And then I moved down the road into what was a big Irish Polish Catholic community around Fulham Broadway, and I lived there and I grew up there until I moved to Australia in 1993.
And why did you move to Australia?
Had an Australian girlfriend, and the question was, shall we get married, or do you want to come and live in my country? So I didn't want to get married, so I was stuck with coming here. So I thought, I'll come to Australia for a year, I'll see how it goes, and then I'll go back. Doesn't matter, I'll go back. And I arrived on, we'd been on a couple of visits prior, so I knew what the country was, but arrived on Derby Day 30 years ago exactly.
In Melbourne,
yeah. Mm. Got off the plane, put a suit on, went straight out to the track, and saw all the Australians that I'd met over the years from Sydney and Melbourne, who all seemed to be at the racetrack for Derby Day. Which is a brilliant introduction, and gives me a really, it's that wonderful thing. I reckon you become, but you start becoming sentient about two, probably. So that means that I've spent half my sentient life exactly in London and half in Australia. So it was a good time to write the memoir.
I want to talk about cultural identity then. So do you feel English or do you feel Australian? What do you dream in, do you think?
That's a really good... I will talk to you in something that a friend of mine in South Africa said, you realise when you become part of your new home when you can name more of the Australian team than your home team. And so for me, that happened in the last British Lions tour. And I went, I've been drinking with these two Wallabies players, and I can name the whole team, and I can name, I don't know, a quarter of the Lions team. So I'm Australian now, and that was it. That was it. So now I'm very much identify myself as Australian. I think, again, I probably identify myself as, I don't identify myself as English. I identify myself as being from West London.
Yeah.
You know, that's where I brought up my, that's very much the football team.
Because you've got a mild accent still. It's mild.
Yes, it's mild, but it's still there. And when I go back, it'll get thicker.
Yeah.
So, but then also I've got ancestors that are American. I got ancestors that are Irish. I got ancestors who were born in Italy. Other ones who were born in India. So there's a whole range of different things. So I'm you know, like so many of us, I'm a bit of a mutt. But yeah, now I always say, London the mother, Melbourne the wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love my mum. Wouldn't want to live with her.
No.
And Melbourne's the place where I've decided to spend the rest of my life.
So Melbourne's the lover.
Oh, no, I'd say Sydney might be the lover. Sydney's the mistress.
Right.
Oh, because you come up here for 4 days, you have a really good time. You know what I mean? But again, I do that in Melbourne.
I go down there and have a really good time.
I think that's a beautiful thing where, you know, the cities are so, everyone in Australia, whether I love Brisbane, I love Adelaide, I love Sydney, I love Perth. I don't buy into this strange competition between states? Because I still think for lots of people it feels a bit like five countries.
Mm.
I know. I think I can't think of there's. I think that that's one of the great joys. And again,
do you know, I do that when I'm in Melbourne, and which I haven't been for a while now. But you know, I'm in a taxi and they say, "Where are you from?" I don't engage in that. Do you know where I say? I say Lebanon. Because I don't want to say Sydney. Because then you get into this thing, you know. Oh, and, you know,
yeah,
Melbourne's,
yeah.
What do you think? Melbourne better than Sydney, blah, blah,
yeah,
blah.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
know, I'll be anywhere where my family is. I'll be in Timbuktu. If my family's there, that's where I'll be.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Yeah, you see, well, you see, I have the advantage of the taxi. I just ask the taxi driver, where should I eat? And that gets around the whole thing. And I guess I say, I'm from Melbourne. Where should I eat? And then we're back in learning some valuable stuff, which is what
okay.
it's about.
How did we come to food? Were you cooking at a young age?
Yeah, I cooked about my first recipe when I was seven. My mum, before she died, gave me the little enamel bowl that I cooked in.
Was she a good cook?
She was a good cook, but like a lot of cooks of her generation, she had a repertoire of maybe eight, nine dishes that were on rotation, and it was just a matter whether chops and peas was going to be on Tuesday or Thursday, and risotto was on Wednesday or Friday, and because Friday was a fish day. So she was a good cook. And my one grandmother was a terrible cook. One grandma was a great cook. And then I mean, always enjoyed eating, always a greedy child. I'm not necessarily fancy fine dining until maybe much later on when I started dating Ginger, that first Australian girlfriend who was really massively into food. But then I had that Cinderella moment, and my life's full of these Cinderella moments where someone goes, I'm starting a new magazine. I know you cook. I know you like to eat. How do you feel about writing a restaurant review for us every week? So it was like I've been paid for the previous 6 years to watch Neighbours and Home and Away, so watch telly for a living.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't I get paid for eating out with my mates?
Yeah.
So I said, well, I want to take my mates. I don't just want to go with two people, and maybe if I go with four, we'll split. You'll pay for two, and I'll pay for the other two, and we'll work it out so that. That it reflects the experience of like if you're going to go to an Indian restaurant, you're probably going to go with a mob of people rather than just a romantic dinner.
Yeah.
So I want to go with the mob of people I want to go with. We get a much more realistic experience. If it's a romantic place, I want to go with the woman I love, and that'd be two. So that was an amazing start. And then from that, I learned, you know, again, started with this attitude that you need to entertain first, then inform, and then be fair. But it's all about you're writing for the reader. Mm. And not for the restaurant.
Mm.
So it's about trying. I want you to get a sense that this is a place you want to spend your money. Mm. And the great review is a place where you want to spend your money, but it's not a place where someone from your office wants to spend the money. You go, I must go there, and she goes, I don't want to go there.
Mm.
And I think that's the art, because, you know, some people want a relaxed family service. Some people find that's too casual, it freaks them out. Some people want a place with buzz and atmosphere. For other people, that buzz and atmosphere translates at noisy and they can't hear what their guests are saying. So again, that's the subtlety of reviewing.
Mm.
You're always trying to match people to an experience they'll love.
And it's also what you feel like that night, you know. Sometimes you just
There's absolutely what you feel like. And certainly as we get older, we can become more particular about. And there are also nights when we feel like, you know, we want to be adventurous, or we don't want to be, we just want to go have something that's reassuring. And that's especially been the case, you know, over the last few years. There's been a real, every so often when something bad happens, you see that people go back to lasagna during the COVID times. Post 9/11, it was all going back to American solid stuff as well.
Yeah, yeah. I was in Tasmania last week, and I had been to the Agrarian Kitchen.
Yeah, amazing.
Amazing. Yeah, yeah. And had a wonderful a la carte meal years ago, so it was pre-COVID. Anyway, I didn't have a reservation this trip, and I thought, you know, I had hired a car, I'll go and see. I was on my own.
You went all that way out there on a whim that you might be able to get in.
Anyway, so I got in there, and she said, well, the menu's changed, and it's $150 for a degustation. And that has to be my least favourite word ever. It's not the way I eat, right? I'm Lebanese. We don't do that. Anyway, and I thought, no, I hate those kind of bits, you know, five courses, blah, blah, blah. So I said, no, I think I'll say no. She said, oh, well, we do have a table. No. Anyway, got to my car and thought, are you crazy? When are you going to come back here? When are you coming? So I went back in there. I enjoyed it thoroughly, but I felt that I had to earn it out. So I had to not eat for the next couple of days until I earned out the $150.
But then you could easy. You could go to a restaurant in Sydney, and you could spend that money and have, you know, and have three courses. And again, that's what's so great about the Agrarian Kitchen. You know,
I love it.
Is this whole thing about where it is?
Yeah.
The old building it's in. Yeah. The fact that the old exercise yard where it is now turned into a walled kitchen garden.
Yeah.
I mean, so you're not just buying the food, you're buying that vision, you're buying the fact that the food's been growing there. And they always, you know, it's that same thing as that when you buy a wine, you're going to spend double the amount for a wine or a coffee that's estate grown.
Yeah. And also you taste the difference. Okay, so you're reviewing food. And when do you start cooking food?
Oh, no, so I'm started cooking all the way from. I mean,
You never stop.
No, self-preservation.
Yeah.
Really. I suppose that period when I moved in with my first girlfriend, who was the Australian who I moved to Australia with, and she was like, oh, I don't cook. I don't know how to cook.
Yeah.
You got to do all the cooking. So then I had to do all the cooking. So I did all the cooking with her for 5 years. So that was great. There's a fair bit in the book about her disapproval of peasant food, like shepherd's pie, which I love.
And then again,
there was some experience. But I was cooking at university. I was cooking with my friends at university. I was experimenting and doing stupid things like seeing what would happen if you dyed mashed potato blue and then it's disgusting, even though it tastes the same. It looks that colour, it doesn't work. And then of course, we moved here. I split up with that Australian girl. And then about a year later, we're still friends. She invites me around for lunch. She cooks this beautiful lunch for me and my new girlfriend. And it's like,
what?
Could you cook? And she went, yeah, for 5 years. You cooked for me and it was amazing. I didn't cook at all. That's so unfair.
Yeah.
And I say, well, maybe that's probably a proof of why the relationship wasn't a good one.
Yeah. Do you know, through those early days when I was in my 20s, I was cooking and I was entertaining. I've always had people around. One point I had this really I lived in a tiny apartment in Surry Hills, like I think it was 45 square metres, and every year I would run a long table from the front door to the end and cook for 20. But this was a moment in my life, and you'll appreciate this. I was fussing around in the kitchen. I had people around, and my friend Bernard was like there, and I'm like, I can't talk to anybody. I've just got to get this done.
Yeah.
And he said, you know what, Cheryl? He said, we don't come here to have restaurant food. He said, we go to a restaurant to have restaurant food. When we come here, we just want your food. And do you know, things turned around for me then.
Yeah, and I think that
isn't that a moment?
But I think that's also the same thing with restaurants as well. You know, there's a great cook, and his great line to me was, it's not about the food on the table, it's about the eyes across the table. That's what matters. And what great restaurants. I mean, there's a tiny, tiny number that are like going to church,
Fat Duck. I've been there.
Yeah, those kind of places where they're gastro. But I'd say Fat Duck is, you'll still laugh at Fat Duck and it's funny and it's joyous. But there are a lot of gastro temples. There are a small number of gastro temples where it's all about the food. But most of the time, it's about the people you're with.
Yes.
And what you really want is an absence of negative. negative. You want, you know, if you get okay service, okay food, and the atmosphere is okay, you'll have a great time with your mates. And that's what eating is about. It's about going out with your mates, and enjoying all your family and enjoying that moment. That it doesn't need to be, you know. And that's why I think when you mention the word degustation, I can see the hackles go up in the back of your neck.
Oh.
It's because invariably that comes with, you know, a description about the wine that you've got that takes 15 minutes while the food's going in front of you and all those negative things rather than that joyous moment. And still the best service I've ever had, sitting in a pub, famous for doing schnitzels. We'd all had schnitzels and we didn't know we were really full. The schnitzels were as you know, size of a toddler's head, freaking gigantic, delicious. And the waitress, and she would have been a grandma, you know, and she just wandered over and she just whispered and she just went, apple crumble with custard. And that was it. And we're like, So again, it doesn't have to be fancy to be joyous, to be memorable, to enhance the experience of the people you're with.
I did a roast chicken dinner last night. I have these friends that love coming over for a roast chicken. And do you know, this is the first time I've done this. I made rice pudding. Because, you know, you put it in the rack below. And
you made Emirati Mandi chicken, we put the chicken on the rack. You grease the rack, chicken on the rack, pot of the rice underneath.
Oh no,
juices drop down into the pot underneath.
No, love
that. Oh my
gosh,
this is what you need to do. This is next level. This is Emirati. So the Emirati is cooked chicken, and it's all the juices in the rice. But anyway, your turn, Cheryl.
No, I made a rice pudding, like sweet rice pudding.
Oh, okay.
It didn't go down well.
Why not?
People said this was breakfast food. I loved it.
And where were they from?
Australia.
They were Spanish Australia. Because absolutely right, Spain, rice puddings, absolutely. You know, congee, you know, there are lots of cultures that do see rice as breakfast food.
Was it
runny or was it baked and didn't have a lovely crust on it?
Yeah, it had that, and I'd put some cardamom and rose water in, and I served it.
Oh, so it's parsam. It's like kheer. It's like Indian style.
And I served it with some roasted, crushed walnuts. I loved it. Well, so, you know, and then she said breakfast food. So you know what I did?
Gave it to them, take them for breakfast.
Yeah, and I had some this morning breakfast.
And look, the Boxing Day tradition was handed down from my dad is Christmas pudding fried on Boxing Day, but he also used to like last night's rice pudding cut into a slab, fried with a little bit of cinnamon and brown sugar over the top just to cut. Oh my gosh, how delicious.
How delicious. Okay, so you've been writing cookbooks, of which I have a number of them.
Yes, thank you.
Tell me why a memoir? Why now?
Well, I think that's a number of things, right? I think you want to avoid doing a memoir when you're cashing in on a certain notoriety or familiarity. So, and two, you need time because it takes a long time to write. This was a two and a half year process. Three, my mother was diagnosed with the blood cancer early onset dementia and Parkinson's at the same time. So like a kind of a trifecta. So you're kind of going, well, that limits the time I've got to talk to her. So that was really important. 30-year anniversary was right. And also I think it's that, you know, I become conscious having written this book and in the conversation when I've been doing the book, talking to other people about their families and the secrets that their family keep hidden and the damaging effect that can have and that kind of the cathartic nature of talking about stuff. And I just wanted to be in a situation where I could talk about all these things and all my children find it at the same time. All my friends know. It has prompted so many conversations with people telling me stuff that they found painful. They don't want to share with anyone else. They share it with you. And there's this wonderful moment where you can see like a weight lift off their shoulders.
Did you worry about what people, like your kids, might think of it?
No, I didn't, because I talked them through it. But yes, I mean, absolutely. But I think you worry about everything, because you worry about most of when we talk about failure. And that's failure, personal failure or failures that are imposed upon you by circumstances. We tend to go, oh, how humiliating is that? And the answer is, well, you know, dancing, this goes back to doing things like masking and dancing. Why is it humiliating? Because it wasn't your fault, so why don't you share it? And invariably when people talk about things that they think, I can't tell anyone, it's humiliating, when you actually share it, mostly you'll find support. Mm. Vulnerability gets greeted with support. Mm. It's arrogance that tends to get greeted with negativity. So so I think that that wonderful time, you're still going to bear the pain of it. But I also think as well that you need to, one of the hard things about writing the book is interrogating yourself to make sure you're being authentic. Now, you obviously, you read a lot. I read a lot. I've read lots and lots of memoirs, some good, some terrible. But there's a certain knee-jerk reaction you're exposed to say about certain situations. And my job was to, you know, I found myself writing that and then going back saying, well, did I really feel like that? Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up the first 5 years without a dad. Did I feel that there was a dad-sized hole in my life that I needed to search out and fill and reconnect with? No, because I knew no better. Whereas I know my friends whose fathers died when they were either 9 or 15, that was a huge, huge negative impact on them. And they really struggled with that. And they did try and fill that gap in many different ways. So I feel myself lucky that I didn't have what they go through.
Which Brian Brown was here the other day.
Oh, yeah,
he grew
sure.
Up, yep. Yeah, single.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, that's I saw that.
He said to me, no, well, it was just the way it was.
And that's exactly the line. Yeah. It's exactly the line. It's just the way it was. And I think a lot of that is different. I mean, I think it doesn't clear that in certain cases, in terms of those cases where you're lucky, right, as I was lucky. So my mother got to keep me, she got support from both my natural father's mum and her own mother. So there was all that support and all that stuff. That's very positive because part of the thing about the book, and I start by talking about my relationship with my grandmothers, like in both cases, they were carrying their own, hiding their own family scandals in terms of one of them gave up her child, which she got pregnant very early on. She gave that child up for fostering, and the other grandmother had a termination. So when they come to that process where their son stroke daughter is carrying, you know, is an unwed mother carrying a child, that experience and that process undoubtedly plays in to how they deal with that conversation. So I'm very conscious of writing the book. You become very conscious of there were three options my mother had, and two of them would mean that either I wasn't here, or, you know, I could be, you know, fostered to a family, as happened to my stepdad, who was fostered out in this terrible scheme where they emptied the orphanage and the foster homes in the UK and sent kids without telling their parents, sent them off to Canada, South Africa and Australia to work on farms, to be in children's homes. Terrible, terrible, terrible.
And treated
absolutely terribly. And it's another one of those kind of things. You see a real stain on there. And then from his perspective, he was told by his foster mother that his mother was dead, even though letters were coming from her that found their way through the kind of the government departments were being sent out. So then he reconnects with his mother aged 23. I had my mother that whole period. I think there's that thing where you do get a sense of perspective on your own life when you talk to other people and you look back at your life and you see, it's so much better. That's so much better.
Jane Cadzow from The Good Weekend interviewed me a few months ago about memoir. I don't know if you saw it, and it was published a couple of weeks ago. And I'm fanatical. I just love it. I love to read other people's stories. I love nonfiction. But it made me think, she made me think about why I loved it, right? Mm. And I think the reason I love it is because I do need to hear other people's experience. And when my mother had, she died 18 months ago now, and she had dementia.
That's right.
And I was, in that last week, we had shifts, the family, and I had the early morning shift. And I devoured memoirs because there was a life lived. There was a life living, and I needed to know how other people were living, and it gave me great comfort. I think memoir does that.
I think also that, you know, I'm in that lucky situation of going that through with my mother and writing the memoir as I'm doing that, allowing me to appreciate, allowing me to find all those other papers. You're saying, have a read of this, have a look at that. I think the interesting thing about memoir is this idea about authenticity is interesting, is that when you actually start looking at memoirs, most aren't written by the person.
Well, yeah.
They're written by a ghost.
Yeah.
And that's a very different experience, yeah. right? Yeah. That's a, because there's not the same interrogation. There's not the same holding yourself to account. And look, I love great ghost writing.
Sure.
Makes a great entertaining reading.
Good story.
But I don't think it, I think it lacks some of the, it lacks some of the rawness.
Mm-hmm.
Because admitting to yourself as you're writing stuff is a form of acceptance, whereas I think reading something that someone else has written about you is much easier to edit out and to remove. So I think you have to be a lot more brutal when you write it yourself. Mm. So that's definitely something now that I've learned from writing my own memoir, is that actually I now look at who's written it. And, you know, if it's a lightweight, joy, you know, football hero story, then that's different. But in terms of best memoirs ever written, for example, Andre Agassi's Open, that's written by a ghostwriter.
Yeah, it's
a great read. But I just think there's something being able to hear the actual voice rather than knowing that everything's gone through another pair of hands, another brain. Mm. I think that maybe changes the experience. It removes them slightly from you.
Mm. Okay, we're almost out of time, so I'm going to ask you, what's your favourite meal?
Favourite meal?
Mm.
Pizza. Sushi. But pizza at night, sushi in the daytime. Sushi, fresh, bright, light, delicious. Pizza, well, it's just dough. You can put anything on it. And at this point, we can play with any flavour. I love that. It's got all your food groups in one piece.
Pepperoni is my
favourite. Pepperoni, cheese, tomato, any chilli, chilli oil.
Yeah, love it. Yeah. What about cooking? What's your favourite thing to cook?
I've got friends coming around. I'll probably do a slow roasted lamb shoulder, and I'll do some hard salads. That shoulder will get rubbed in a mix of probably two parts coriander seed, one part cumin seed, ground up, and then yogurt, roast beetroot, all that stuff to play with. I think easy, and then it's that whole thing about any meal. You know, the lamb shoulder goes in 4 hours. It doesn't matter whether people are half an hour late or half an hour early. The salads are all done. They're mostly hard salads, you know, frica or that beetroot salad. So you can either dress them at the time or you can dress them in advance, but they're basically done. And so you can just, when your friends arrive, enjoy your friends and just pull everything out.
Mm, love a meal like that. It's low maintenance, right?
Yeah, well, and again, it's like everything. Is you plan to succeed and let the oven do the work. That's the great joy.
Mm. Aren't we lucky?
Yeah,
that amazing. We can cook. It is. It's amazing.
Yeah, but that old cliche. But anyone can cook. Putting a lamb shoulder in the oven ain't that hard.
It's just
a matter of the right heat and away you go. Making a salad is just a matter of no more than three ingredients and putting them together
with
a suitable dressing. So again, all these things are easy. And again, you don't need to be doing a restaurant quality deal. Just that lamb shoulder pulled apart with some mint jelly, some cucumber and some yogurt in flatbread.
Mm. Favourite meat is lamb. Okay, Matt Preston, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Cheryl.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere. Or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.